Patton, I might not look like no buzzard, but I'd sure look like a crow.
Penny's strength was slow in returning. The swelling from the poisoning had gone down. The skin was sloughing away where the rattler had struck him, and he had cut the wounds to make the envenomed blood flow more freely. But at the least exertion, he was nauseated, and his heart pumped like the paddle wheels on the river steamers, and he gasped for breath and must lie flat to recover himself. He was all wiry nerves, strung like harp strings on a frail wooden body. To Jody, the presence of Buck was a stimulation so great that he was feverish with it. The fawn alone would have had him delirious. The two together kept him in a daze, wandering from Penny's room to wherever Buck was working, to wherever the fawn might be, and around again. His mother said, "You'd ought to be noticing all what Buck is doing, so you can do it when he's gone." There was a tacit understanding among the three of them that Penny was to be spared. The morning of the eighth day that Buck had been at the clearing, he called Jody to the cornfield. Vandals had visited it during the night. Half a row of corn had been stripped of its ears. Midway of the row lay a pile of corn husks. Buck said,
"You know who had done that?"
"Coons?"
"Hell no. Foxes. Foxes love corn gooder than I do. 2-3 of them bushy-tailed scapers come in last night and had them a pure picnic."
Jody laughed out.
"A fox picnic? I'd love to have seen it."
Buck said sternly,
"You'd ought to be out at night with your gun keeping them out. Now we'll get 'em tonight. You got to learn to be serious. And this evening, we'll rob that bee tree by the sinkhole, and that'll learn you how to do that."
Jody went through the day impatiently. A hunt with Buck had a different quality from a hunt with his father. There was an excitement in anything the foresters did that made him nervous and high-keyed. There was noise and confusion. A hunt with Penny held a satisfaction that was of more than the chase. There was always time to see a bird fly over or to listen to a gator bellowing in the swamp. He wished that Penny were able to be about to rob the bee tree with him, to go on the trail of the robber foxes. In mid-afternoon, Buck came from the new ground. Penny was sleeping. Buck said to Ma Baxter,
"I want a lard pail and an axe and a heap of rags to burn for smudges."
There were not many rags in the Baxter household. Clothes were worn and patched and mended until they dropped in ribbons. Flour sacks went into aprons and dish towels and chair backs that she embroidered on winter evenings, into backs for patchwork quilts. Buck looked disgustedly at the small handful she gave him. He said,
"Well, reckon we can use moss."
She said,
"Don't y'all get stung now. My grandpappy got himself stung once to where he was in the bed a fortnight."
"If we get stung, it sure won't be a purpose."
He started across the yard with Jody beside him. The fawn was close behind.
"You want your blasted baby to get stung to death? Then shut him up."
Jody led the fawn reluctantly to the shed and closed the door. He hated to be separated from it, even for honey hunting. It seemed unjust that Penny should not be along. He had had his eye on the bee tree all spring. He had waited for the proper time when the bees should have gathered their nectar from the yellow jessamine, from the mulberry and the holly, the palmetto bloom and the china berry, the wild grapes and the peaches, and from the hawthorn and wild plum. There would still be bloom from which they might make their own winter store. The red bay and the loblolly were in full blossom. There would soon be sumac and goldenrod and asters. Buck said,
"You know who'd purely love to be getting honey with us? Fodderwing. He'll work amongst the bees so quiet, you'd figure they was making him a present of the honeycomb."
They reached the sinkhole. Buck said,
"I don't see how y'all made out toting your water so fur. If I wasn't about to be leaving, I'd sure have to dig a well nigh to the house."
"You fixin' to leave?"
"Well, yes. I'm fretted about Fodderwing, and I ain't never lived this long without whiskey."
The bee tree was a dead pine. Midway up its height, the wild honeybees flew in and out of a deep cavity. It stood at the north edge of the sinkhole. Buck stopped by the live oaks to pull down armfuls of green Spanish moss. At the base of the pine, he pointed to a pile of dried grass and feathers.
"The wood ducks tried to nest there," he said. "They'll see a hole in a tree, and it don't matter do it belong to a Lord God woodpecker or one of them big woodpeckers with a ivory bill or a swarm of bees. They'll take a notion to it, and they'll try to nest in the hole. The bees has done drove these uns out."
He began to chop at the base of the dead pine. High in the air, a humming sounded like a den of rattlers, far distant and turbulent. The blows of the axe echoed back and forth across the sinkhole. Squirrels, quiescent in the oaks and palm trees, began to chatter at the disturbance. Scrub jays cried shrilly. The pines shook. The humming grew into a roar. The bees sung across their heads like small shot. Buck called,
"Light me smudge, boy. Be peart."
Jody made a loose ball of moss and rags and opened Buck's tinderhorn. He struggled with flint and steel. Penny was so expert at starting a fire that it occurred to Jody, in a panic, that he had never done it himself. The sparks flashed to the scorched rags that constituted the tinder, but he blew them so violently that they flickered out almost as soon as they touched the cloth. Buck dropped the axe and ran to him and took the materials from him. He rubbed flint and steel together as vigorously as Jody had done, but he blew on the spark-touched rags with a judiciousness amazing in a forester. The rags blazed, and he touched the fire to the moss. It began to smoke without blazing. Buck ran back to the pine and put his muscles behind the axe. Its bright blade ate into the decayed center of the tree. Its long fibers split and ripped and shivered. The pine roared in the air as though a voice had come to it to cry out with in its falling. It crashed to earth, and the bees were a cloud across its dead, gaping heart. Buck snatched up the smudge and darted in as quick for all his size as a weasel. He stuffed the smoking ball into the cavity with one thrust and ran madly. He looked more than ever like a lumbering bear. He let out a howl and slapped at his chest and shoulders. Jody had to laugh at him. Then a needle point of fire stabbed his own neck. Buck shouted,
"Get down the sinkhole! Get to the water!"
They scrambled down the steep bank. The seepage pool at the bottom was shallow for lack of rains. The water didn't quite cover them when they lay in it. Buck scooped up handfuls of mud and plastered Jody's hair and neck with it. His own thatch was a thick enough protection. A few bees followed and swung back and forth persistently. After a time, Buck raised himself cautiously. He said,
"They're due to be quiet now, but ain't we a pair of hogs?"
Their breeches, their faces, their shirts were caked with mud. It was not yet wash day, and Jody led the way up the south wall of the sinkhole to the wash troughs. They sousled their clothes in one and washed themselves from the other. Buck said,
"What you grinning about?"
Jody shook his head. He could imagine his mother saying,
"If it takes bees to get a forester clean, I'll hive 'em a swarm."
Buck had half a dozen stings, but Jody had escaped with two. They approached the bee tree cautiously. The smudge had been properly placed. The bees were drugged with the heavy smoke. They swarmed slowly around the cavity, searching for their queen. Buck split a wider opening and used his sheath knife to hack away the edges. He cleaned away trash and splinters and reached in with a knife. He turned, amazed.
"Great day! There's a wash tub of honey here. The tree's full!"
He brought out a slab, golden and dripping. The comb was rough and dark, but the honey was paler than fine syrup. They filled the lard pail and carried it between them to the house. Ma Baxter gave them a cypress tub to take back with them. Buck said,
"Now a wash tub of biscuits is all more is needed."
The return load was heavy. It was the largest yield, Buck said, he had ever seen from a bee tree since he was a boy. He said,
"When I go home tomorrow and tell my folks, they'll not believe me."
She said slowly,
"I reckon you'll want to carry some back with you."
"No more'n I can carry in my belly. I got my eye on 2-3 trees in the swamp. Do they fail me, I'm like to come begging."
Ma Baxter said,
"You've been mighty neighborly. Maybe someday we'll have a plenty and can do for you,"
Jody said.
"I wish you'd not go, Buck."
The big man shoved him playfully.
"With me gone, you'll not have no time to nuss that fawn."
Buck was plainly restless. He shuffled his feet at supper and paced up and down afterward. He looked at the sky. He said,
"A good clear night for riding."
Jody said,
"How come you're anxious all to once it?"
Buck paused in his pacing.
"I get that away. I like to come and I like to go. Wherever I be, I'm content a while. Then I just some way ain't content no more. When me and Lem and Millwheel goes off hoss trading to Kentucky, I'll swear I figure I'll bust till I get home again."
He paused and stared into the sunset. He added in a low voice,
"And I'm right smart fretted about Fodder Wing. I got a feeling here."
He thumped his hairy chest.
"He ain't doing good."
"Wouldn't somebody have come?"
"That's it. If they didn't know your pa was bad off, they'd have ridden over just to say howdy. They figured your pa needed help, and they'd not like to toll me away was the news bad or worrisome."
He waited nervously for dark. He wanted to be done with his job and gone. Penny was as good a night hunter as any forester. Jody was tempted to brag of the varmints his father had disposed of, but that might cut him out of a night prowl with Buck. He held his tongue. He helped Buck prepare the fat wood splinters for the fire pan. Buck said,
"My Uncle Cotton had red hair. They was a heap of it, stood up like a haystack, and red as a fighting coxcomb. He was fire hunting one night, and the handle was a mite short, and the spark from the pan set his hair afire. And you know when he hollered to Pa for help, Pa didn't pay him no mind. He just thought the moon had done rose and was shining through Uncle Cotton's hair."
Jody gaped.
"Is that true, Buck?"
Buck whittled busily.
"Now, if you was to tell me a tale," he said, "I'd not ask you no such of a question."
Penny called from his bedroom.
"I can't stand it. I'm a good notion not to leave you go without me."
They came to his room.
"If 'twas a panther hunt you was going on," he said, "I'll swear I'd feel good enough to go with you."
Buck said,
"Now, I'd just carry you on a panther hunt did I have my dogs." "Why, my pair'll out-hunt your whole pack."
He asked innocently,
"How'd y'all come out with that sorry dog I traded you?"
Buck drawled,
"Why, that dog's proved out the fastest and the finest and the hardest hunting and the fearlessest of every dog we've ever had on the place. All he needed was men to train him."
Penny chuckled. He said,
"I'm proud you're smart enough to make something out in him. Where's he now?" "Well, he was so blasted good, he put the other dog so to shame, Lem couldn't abide it, and he hauled off and shot him and buried him in the Baxter Cemetery one night."
Penny said gravely,
"I noticed the new grave, and I figured y'all would give out in burying ground. I'll whittle a headstone, time to get my strength. I'll carve on it, 'Here lies a forester, mourned by all his kin.'"
He grinned broadly and slapped the covers of his bed.
"Give in, Buck," he said, "give in."
Buck wiped his beard.
"All right," he said, "I'll take it for funnin', but don't look to Lem to take it for everything but a cold-out insult."
Penny said,
No hard feelings. I got none, and I hope y'all'll hold none, Lem nor nobody.
Lem's different. He takes things personal.
Now that grieves me. I pitched into the fight betwixt him and Oliver because they was too many of you on one side.
Buck said,
Well, blood's thicker than water. We fight amongst ourselves now and again, but when it's us and the other feller, we allus fight on the same side of the creek. But me and you has got no call to fall out.
Words began fights, and words ended them. Jody asked,
If fellers didn't say quarreling things, would they put in to fight?
Penny said,
I'm feared so. I once had seen a pair of deaf dummies having it. But they do say they got a sign language, and likely one passed the insult in a sign.
Buck said,
It's male nature, boy. Wait till you get to courtin', and you'll get your britches dusted many a time.
But nobody but Lem and Oliver was courtin', and here all us Baxters and all you Foresters was into it, Penny said.
There's no end to what a man'll fight for. I even knowed a preacher, takin' off his coat and fit airy man wouldn't agree to infant damnation. All a feller can do is fight for what he figures is right, and the devil take the hindmost.
Buck said,
Listen, I think I heard a fox bark then in the hammock.
At first the night seemed silent. Then sounds drifted like clouds into their hearing. A tree frog scraped his fiddle and predicted rain. Buck said,
There he be.
A thin bark sounded in the distance, shrill and mournful.
Buck said, Now, wouldn't that be music to my poor dogs? Wouldn't they sing to that sopraner?
Penny said, If you and Jody don't clean out the litter tonight, bring your dogs on the next moon and we'll have us chase.
Buck said, Let's us get going, Jody. That yipper'll about make the cornfield time we do.
He picked up Penny's shotgun from the corner.
I'll borry this tonight. Seems to me I've seed it before.
Just don't bury it beside the dog, Penny said. It's really a good gun.
Jody packed his muzzle loader over his shoulder. He went out with Buck. The fawn heard him and bleated from the shed. They walked under the mulberries and crossed the split rail fence into the cornfield. Buck walked north down the first row. At the far end of the field, he began walking across the ends of the rows. He stopped at each row and focused the light from the fire pan down the length of the field. Midway, he stopped. He turned and nudged Jody. Where the light came to rest, two fiery green agates caught the light. He murmured,
Slip halfway up the row. I'll keep the light on him. Don't get in the path of the light. When his eyes look as big as a shilling, give it to him right between them.
Jody crept forward, hugging the corn at his left. The green lights were extinguished a moment, then stared again. He lifted his gun and allowed the light from the blazing splinters in the fire pan to slip down the barrel. He pulled the trigger. The gun, as always, knocked him off balance. He started to run forward to ascertain his hit, but Buck hissed at him.
Psst! You got him. Leave him lay. Come back.
He crept along the row. Buck handed him the shotgun.
There's likely another here closed.
They crept from row to row. This time he saw the glowing eyes before Buck saw them. He advanced down the row as before. The shotgun was a delight to handle. It was lighter than the old muzzle loader, not so long, and easier to sight. He shot with a feeling of confidence. Again, Buck called him back, and he retreated. But though they combed the rows carefully and worked around the west end of the field and flashed the light down the corn rows from the south, there were no more bright green eyes. Buck said aloud,
That's the crop for tonight. Let's see what we got.
Both shots had killed. One was a dog fox and one a vixen, fat with Baxter corn. Buck said.
Now they got a litter off in the den some mares, but they'll be part growed and can make out by theirselves. Come fall, we'll have us a fox chase.
The foxes were gray and in good condition, with full brushes. Jody carried them in complacently. Approaching the cabin, they heard a commotion. Ma Baxter shrieked. Buck said,
Your ma wouldn't romp on your pa while he was ailing, would she?
She don't never romp on him with nothing but talking.
I'd a heap rather a woman tore me down with a lighter knot than speaking sharp.
Close to the cabin, they heard Penny shout. Buck said,
Why, boy, the woman's killing him.
Jody said, Something's after the fawn. The yard itself was not often disturbed by anything more dangerous than the small varmints. Buck hurdled the fence, and Jody vaulted it after him. A light shone from the doorway. Penny stood there, dressed only in his breeches. Ma Baxter was beside him, flapping her apron. Jody thought he saw a dark form move off into the night toward the grape arbor, followed by the dogs baying. Penny called him.
It's a bear! Get him! Get him before he makes the fence!
Sparks showered from the fire pan as Buck ran. The light reached out to a lumbering body galloping to the east under the peach trees. Jody shouted,
Give me the fire pan, Buck, and you do the shooting.
He felt frightened and incompetent. They exchanged on the run. At the fence, the bear turned at bay. He slashed at the dogs. His eyes and teeth shone in the spasmodic light. Then he turned to clamber over the fence. Buck shot. The bear tumbled. The dogs broke into a tumult. Penny came running. The light showed a kill. The dogs made a pretense of having done the job and bayed and attacked proudly. Buck was smug. He said,
This feller'd not have come around if he'd known they was a forester on the place.
Penny said,
He smelt things, set 'em so wild he'd not have noticed the whole tribe of you. What was that?
Jody's fawn and the new honey.
Did he get to the fawn, Pa? Oh, Pa, the fawn ain't hurt.
He never got to him. The door, by luck, was closed. Then he must have winded the honey and come traipsing around by the stoop. I figure it was you all coming back, and I didn't pay no mind until he knocked the cover off on the honey. I could have shot him down right at the door, but here I was and no gun. All me and Ori could do was holler, but I reckon it was the fiercest hollering he'd ever run into, and he lit out.
Jody was weak at thought of what might have happened to the fawn. He ran to the shed to comfort it, and found it drowsy and unconcerned. He stroked it gratefully, then returned to the men and the bear. It was a 2-year-old male, in good condition. Penny insisted on helping with the dressing. They dragged the carcass to the backyard and skinned it out by the light of the fire pan, quartered it, and hung the meat in the smokehouse. Buck said,
Now I will beg a pail of the fat for Ma to make her some bear grease and cracklings. There's things she just won't fry without bear grease, and the old soul says bear cracklings and sweet potatoes rest so easy on her gums. Why, them 4 teeth of hers could chomp on 'em all day.
Ma Baxter developed generosity with the plentitude. She said,
And a big piece of the liver goes to poor little fodder wing. It'll give him strength.
Penny said,
I'm only sad this ain't old Slewfoot. My, wouldn't I love to draw the knife down his thieving backbone.
The foxes could wait to be skinned until morning, for the meat would be used only to cook for the chickens, with pepper for a tonic. Buck said,
Did old man Easy Ozell ever ask you to come eat one of his fox pilaws?
Penny said,
He done so, and I said, No, thank you, Easy. I'll just wait until you cook one of your dogs.
Penny was thriving on the excitement. He sat on his heels beside Buck and exchanged tales of foxes and of dogs, of strange foods and the stranger people who ate them. The yarns, for once, failed to hold Jody's interest. He was anxious for everyone to go to bed. At last Penny's newfound energy failed him, and he washed his hands and cleaned his skinning knife and joined his wife in the bed. Buck was wound up to talk half the night. Jody knew the signs and pretended to go to sleep on his pallet on the floor of his small room. Buck had been occupying his bed, his long hairy legs hanging unsupported a quarter of its length. Buck sat on the edge of the bed and talked until the lack of audience discouraged him. Jody heard him yawn and pull off his trousers and lie down on the corn shucks mattress on the creaking slats. He waited until a deep, rumbling snore sounded. Then he slipped from the house and groped his way to the shed. The fawn stood up at the sound. He felt his way to it and threw his arms around its neck. It nuzzled his cheek. He picked it up and carried it to the door. It had grown so fast in the brief time he had had it that it was all he could do to carry it. He tiptoed into the yard with it and set it down. It followed him willingly. He crept into the house, keeping one hand on its smooth, hard head to guide it. Its sharp heels clicked on the wooden floor. He lifted it again and stepped cautiously past his mother's bedroom and into his own. He lay down on his pallet and drew the fawn down beside him. He often lay so with it in the shed or under the live oaks in the heat of the day. He lay with his head against its side, its ribs lifted and fell with its breathing. It rested its chin on his hand. It had a few short hairs there that prickled him. He had been cudgeling his wits for an excuse to bring the fawn inside at night to sleep with him, and now he had one that couldn't be disputed. He would smuggle it in and out as long as possible in the name of peace. On the inevitable day when he should be discovered, what better reason was there than the menace, the constant danger, he would point out, of bears? Chapter 17. There was not a field of sweet potatoes, but an endless sea. Jody looked behind him at the rows he had finished hoeing. They were beginning to make a respectable showing, but the rows unfinished seemed to stretch to the horizon. The July heat simmered on the earth. The sand was scalding to his bare feet. The leaves of the sweet potato vines curled upward as though the dry soil and not the sun were burning them. He pushed back his palmetto hat and wiped his face with his sleeve. By the sun, it must be nearly 10 o'clock. His father had said that if the sweet potatoes were hoed by noon, he might go in the afternoon to see Fodder Wing and get a name for the fawn. The fawn lay in the hedgerow in the shade of an elderberry bush. It had been almost a nuisance when he began his work. It had galloped up and down the sweet potato beds, trampling the vines and knocking down the edges of the beds. It had come and stood in front of him in the direct path of his hoeing, refusing to move, to force him to play with it. The wide-eyed, wondering expression of its first weeks with him had given way to an alert awareness. It had as wise a look as old Julia. Jody had almost decided that he would have to lead it back and shut it up in the shed, when of its own accord it sought the shade and lay down. It lay watching him from the corner of one big eye, its head in its favorite position, twisted back against its own shoulder. Its white tail flicked now and then, and its spotted hide rippled, shaking off flies. If it would stay quiet, he could make better time at the hoeing. He liked to work with it near. It gave him a comfortable feeling that he had never had before in the company of a hoe. He attacked the weeds again lustily and was pleased with himself to see his own progress. The rows fell away behind him. He whistled tunelessly. He had thought of many names for the fawn, had called it by each in turn, but not one pleased him. All the names by which the dogs of his acquaintance had been called, Joe and Grab, Rover and Rob, on down the line, all were inadequate. It had such a light way of walking, tippy-toed, as Penny put it, that he would have named it Twinkle Toes and called it Twink for short, but that reminded him of Twink Weatherby and spoiled the name. Tip, itself, would not do, because Penny had once had an ugly and vicious bulldog by the name. Fodderwing wouldn't fail him. He had a great gift for naming his own pets. He had Racket, the raccoon, Push, the possum, Squeak, the squirrel, and Preacher, the lame redbird who sang from his perch,
Preacher, preacher, preacher.
Fodderwing said the other redbirds came to him from the forest to be married, but Jody had heard other redbirds sing the same words. At any rate, it was a good name. He had done a great deal of work in the 2 weeks since Buck had gone home. Penny's strength was returning, but every now and then he became faint and dizzy, and his heart pounded. Penny was sure it was the lingering effect of the rattlesnake venom, but Ma Baxter believed it was the fever and dosed him with lemon leaf tea. It was good to have him up and about again, with the cold fear gone. Jody tried to remember to spare him. It was so good to have the fawn, to be relieved of the dull, lonely ache that had overtaken him so often, that he was filled with gratitude for his mother's tolerance of its presence. There was no question but that it did require a great deal of milk. It undoubtedly got in her way. It came into the house one day and discovered a pan of cornbread stirred up, ready for baking. It had cleaned the pan. Since then it had eaten green leaves, cornmeal mixed with water, bits of biscuit, almost anything. It had to be shut in the shed when the Baxters ate. It butted and bleated and knocked dishes out of their hands. When Jody and Penny laughed at it, it tossed its head knowingly. The dogs, at first, had baited it, but they were now tolerant. Ma Baxter was tolerant, but she was never amused. Jody pointed out its charms.
"Ain't his eyes pretty, Ma? They see a pan of cornbread too fur. Well, ain't he got a cute, foolish tail, Ma?
All deer's flags look the same,
but Ma, ain't it cute and foolish?
It's foolish, all right."
The sun crept toward its zenith. The fawn came into the sweet potatoes and nibbled a few tender vines, then returned to the hedgerow and found a new place of shade under a wild cherry tree. Jody checked his work. He had a row and a half yet undone. He would have liked to go to the house for a drink of water, but that would cut down his remaining time too sharply. Perhaps dinner would be late. He pulled the hoe as fast as he dared without cutting the vines. When the sun stood overhead, he had finished the half row, and the full row stretched mockingly before him. In a moment now, his mother would beat on the iron ring by the kitchen door, and he would have to stop. Penny had made it plain that there would be no quarter as to time. If the hoeing was not finished by dinner time, there would be no visit to Fodderwing. He heard steps on the other side of the fence. Penny was standing there watching him.
Heap of taters, ain't it, son?
It's a mort of 'em.
Hard to think this time next year there'll not be one left. That baby of yours there under the cherry tree, he'll be wanting his share of 'em. Remember the time we had 2 year gone keeping the deer out?
Pa, I can't make it. I ain't scarcely stopped all morning, and I've yet got a row.
Well, now, I tell you, I ain't fixing to let you off, for I said I'd not. But I'll strike a bargain. You go fetch fresh water for your ma from the sinkhole, and I'll finish the taters this evening. Climbing the walls of that sinkhole purely beats me. Now, that's a fair deal.
Jody dropped the hoe and started on a run for the house to get the water buckets. Penny called after him.
Don't try to tote 'em plumb full. A yearling ain't got a buck strength.
The buckets alone were heavy. They were of hand-hewn cypress, and the ox yoke from which they hung was of white oak. Jody hung the yoke over his shoulders and trotted down the road. The fawn loped after him. The sinkhole was dark and still. There was more sunlight in the early morning and at evening than at noon, for the thick leaves of the trees cut off the overhead sun. The birds were still. Around the sandy rim of the sinkhole, they were nooning and dusting themselves. In late afternoon, they would fly down for water. The doves would come, and the juries, and the redbirds, and the bee martins, the mockingbirds, and the quail. He couldn't be too hurried to run down the steep slope to the bottom of the great green bowl. The fawn followed, and they splashed together across the pool. The fawn bent its head to drink. He had dreamed of this. He said to it,
"Someday I'll build me a house here, and I'll get you dough, and we'll all live here by the pool."
A frog leaped and the fawn backed away. Jody laughed at it and ran up the slope to the drinking trough. He leaned over it to drink. The fawn, following, drank with him, sucking up the water and moving its mouth up and down the length of the trough. At one moment, its head was against Jody's cheek, and he sucked in the water with the same sound as the fawn for the sake of companionship. He lifted his head and shook it and wiped his mouth. The fawn lifted its head, too, and the water dropped from its muzzle. Jody filled the buckets with the gourd dipper that hung on the rim of the trough. Against his father's warning, he filled them nearly full. He would like to walk into the yard with them. He crouched and bent his shoulders under the yoke. When he straightened, he couldn't rise against the weight. He dipped out part of the water and was able to stand and pull his way up the remainder of the slope. The wooden yoke cut into his thin shoulders. His back ached. Halfway home, he was obliged to stop and set down the buckets and pour out more of the water. The fawn dipped its nose inquisitively into one of the buckets. Fortunately, his mother need not know. She couldn't understand how clean the fawn was, and wouldn't admit how sweet it smelled. They were at dinner when he reached the house. He lifted the buckets to the water shelf and shut up the fawn. He filled the water pitcher from the fresh buckets and took it into the table. He had worked so hard and was so hot and tired that he was not particularly hungry. He was glad of this and was able to set aside a large portion of his own dinner for the fawn. The meat was a pot roast from the bear's haunch, pickled and brined for keeping. It was a trifle coarse, with long fibers, but the flavor, he thought, was better than beef and almost as good as venison. He made his meal on the meat, with a helping of collard greens, and saved all his corn pone and his milk for the fawn. Penny said, "We was mighty lucky 'twas a young bear like this and come scapering under our noses. Had it been a big old male, we couldn't have et the meat this time of year. The bears mate in July, Jody, and allus remember the meat of the males ain't fitting when they're mating. Don't never shoot one then, unless it's bothering you."
"Why ain't the meat fitting?"
"Now, I don't know. But when they're courting, they're mean and hateful."
"Like Lem and Oliver?"
"Like Lem and Oliver. Their gorge rises, or their spleen, and seems like the hatefulness gets right into their flesh."
Ma Baxter said, "A boar hog's the same, only he's that-a-way the year round." "Well, Pa, do the male bears fight?"
"They'll fight terrible. The females stand off and watch the fighting."
"Like Twink Weatherby?"
"Like Twink Weatherby. And then she'll go off with the one wins the fight. They'll stay in pairs all through July, maybe into August. Then the males goes off and the cubs is born in February. And don't you think a male like old Slewfoot won't eat them cubs, do he come on 'em? That's another reason I hate bears. They ain't natural in their affections."
Ma Baxter said to Jody, "You look out now, walking to Foresters today. A mating bear's the thing to shun."
Penny said, "Just keep your eyes open. You're all right as long as you see a creeter first and don't take 'em by surprise. Even that rattlesnake that got me, why, I taken him by surprise, and he wasn't no more'n looking out for hisself."
Ma Baxter said, "You'd stick up for the devil hisself."
"I reckon I would. The devil gets blamed for a heap of things as nothing but human cussedness."
She asked suspiciously, "Jody finishes hoeing like he belonged to?"
Penny said blandly, "He finished his contract."
He winked at Jody, and Jody winked back. There was no use in trying to explain the difference to her. She was outside the good male understanding. He said, "Ma, can I go now?" "Let's see. I'll need a mite of wood toted in. Please don't think up nothing long to do, Ma. You wouldn't want I should be so late getting home tonight. The bears would get me."
"You be later and dark getting home, and you'll wish 'twas a bear had you stead of me."
He filled the wood box and was ready to go. His mother made him change his shirt and comb his hair. He fretted at the delay. She said, "I just want them dirty foresters to know there's folks does live decent." He said, "They ain't dirty. They just live nice and natural and enjoy themselves." She sniffed.
He let out the fawn from the shed, fed it from his hand, held the pan of milk mixed with water for it to drink, and the two set off. The fawn ran sometimes behind him, sometimes ahead, making short forays into the brush, bounding back to him in an alarm that Jody was sure was only pretended. Sometimes it walked beside him, and this was the best. He laid his hand then lightly on its neck and fitted the rhythm of his two legs to its four. He imagined that he was another fawn. He bent his legs at the knees, imitating its walk. He threw his head up alertly. A rabbit pea vine was in blossom beside the road. He pulled a length of it and twined it around the fawn's neck for a halter. The rosy blooms made the fawn so pretty that it seemed to him even his mother would admire it. If it faded before he returned, he would make a fresh halter on the way home. At the crossroads near the abandoned clearing, the fawn halted and lifted its nostrils into the wind. It pricked up its ears. It turned its head this way and that, savoring the air. He turned his own nose in the direction on which it seemed to settle. A strong odor came to him, pungent and rank. He felt the hair prickle on the back of his neck. He thought he heard a low rumbling sound, and then a snapping that might be of teeth. He was tempted to turn tail and head for home, yet he would always wonder what the sounds had been. He moved one step at a time around the turn in the road. The fawn stayed motionless behind him. He stopped short. Two male bears were moving slowly ahead down the road, 100 yards distant. They were on their hind legs, walking like men, shoulder to shoulder. Their walk seemed almost a dance, as when couples in the square dance moved side by side to do a figure. Suddenly, they jostled each other, like wrestlers, and lifted their forepaws and turned, snarling, each trying for the other's throat. One raked his claws across the other's head, and the snarls grew to a roar. The fighting was violent for a few moments. Then the pair walked on, boxing, jostling, parrying. The wind was in Jody's favor. They could never smell him. He crept down the road after them, keeping his distance. He couldn't bear to lose sight of them. He hoped they would fight to a finish, yet he should be terrorized if one should end the fight and turn his way. He decided that they had been fighting for a long time and were exhausted. There was blood in the sand. Each attack seemed less violent than the others. Each shoulder-to-shoulder walking was slower paced. As he stared, a female walked out of the bushes ahead, with three males following her. They turned silently into the road and walked on in single file. The fighting pair swung their heads a moment, then fell in behind. Jody stood until the procession passed from sight, solemn and ludicrous and exciting. He turned and ran back to the crossroads. The fawn was nowhere to be seen. He called, and it emerged from the scrub growth at the side of the road. He took the forester's road and ran down it. Now that it was over, he shook at his own boldness. But it was done now, and he would follow again, for all men were not privileged to see the creatures in their private moments. He thought, I've seen a thing. It was good to become old and see the sights and hear the sounds that men saw and heard, like Buck and his father. That was why he liked to lie flat on his belly on the floor or on the earth before the campfire while men talked. They had seen marvels, and the older they were, the more marvels they had seen. He felt himself moving into a mystic company. He had a tale now of his own to tell on winter evenings. His father would say, Jody, tell about the time you seed the two male bears fighting down the road. Above all, he could tell Fodderwing. He ran again for pleasure in his hurry to tell his friend his story. He would surprise him. He would walk up to Fodderwing in the woods, or back of the house among his pets, or to his bed if he were still ailing. The fawn would walk beside him. Fodderwing's face would shine with its strange brightness. He would haunch his twisted body close and put out his gentle and crooked hand and touch the fawn. He would smile, to know that he, Jody, was content. After a long time, Fodderwing would speak, and what he said would be perhaps peculiar, but it would be beautiful. Jody reached the forester land and hurried under the live oaks into the open yard. The house was somnolent. There was no curl of smoke from the chimney, there were no dogs in sight, but a hound was howling from the dog pen at the rear. The foresters were probably all sleeping through the heat of the early afternoon. But when they slept in the daytime, they overflowed the house out to the veranda under the trees. He stopped and called.
Fodderwing, it's Jody.
The hound whined. A chair scraped on the board floor inside the house. Buck came to the door. He looked down at Jody and passed his hand over his mouth. His eyes were unseeing. It seemed to Jody that he must be drunk. Jody faltered.
I come to see Fodderwing. I come to show him my fawn.
Buck shook his head as though he would shake away a bee that annoyed him, or his thoughts. He wiped his mouth again. Jody said,
I come special.
Buck said,
He's dead.
The words had no meaning. They were only two brown leaves that blew past him into the air. But a coldness followed their passing, and a numbness took him. He was confused. He repeated,
I come to see him.
You come too late. I'd have fought you if there'd been time. There wasn't time to fought old Doc. One minute he was breathing. The next minute he just wasn't. Like as if you blowed out a candle.
Jody stared at Buck, and Buck stared back at him. The numbness grew into a paralysis. He felt no sorrow, only a coldness and a faintness. Fodderwing was neither dead nor alive. He was simply nowhere at all. Buck said hoarsely,
You can come look at him.
First Buck said that Fodderwing was gone, like candlelight, and then he said that he was here. None of it made sense. Buck turned into the house. He looked back, compelling Jody with his dull eyes. Jody lifted one leg after the other and mounted the steps. He followed Buck into the house. The forester men sat all together. There was a oneness about them, sitting so, motionless and heavy. They were pieces of one great, dark rock, broken into separate men. Pa Forrester turned his head and looked at Jody as though he were a stranger. Then he turned it away again. Lem and Millwheel looked at him. The others didn't stir. It seemed to Jody that they saw him from over a wall they had built against him. They were unwilling to hold the sight of him. Buck groped for his hand. He led him toward the large bedroom. He started to speak. His voice broke. He stopped and gripped Jody's shoulder. He said,
Bear up.
Fodderwing lay with closed eyes, small and lost in the center of the great bed. He was smaller than when he had lain sleeping on his pallet. He was covered with a sheet turned back beneath his chin. His arms were outside the sheet, folded across his chest, the palms of the hands falling outward, twisted and clumsy, as in life. Jody was frightened. Ma Forrester sat by the side of the bed. She held her apron over her head and rocked herself back and forth. She flung down the apron. She said,
I've lost my boy, my poor crookedy boy.
She covered herself again and swayed from side to side. She moaned,
The Lord's hard, oh, the Lord's hard.
Jody wanted to run away. The bony face on the pillow terrified him. It was Fodderwing, and it was not Fodderwing. Buck drew him to the edge of the bed.
He'll not hear, but speak to him.
Jody's throat worked. No words came. Fodderwing seemed made of tallow, like a candle. Suddenly, he was familiar. Jody whispered, "Hey." The paralysis broke, having spoken. His throat tightened as though a rope choked it. Father Wing's silence was intolerable. Now he understood. This was death. Death was a silence that gave back no answer. Father Wing would never speak to him again. He turned and buried his face against Buck's chest. The big arms gripped him. He stood a long time. Buck said,
"I knowed you'd hate it fearful."
They left the room. Paul Forrester beckoned to him. He went to his side. The old man stroked his arm. He waved at the circle of brooding men. He said,
"Ain't it quare now? We could have spared nigh every one of them fellers. The one we can't spare was the one was taken,"
he added brightly,
"and him a swiveled no-count thing, too."
He sank back in his rocking chair, pondering the paradox. Jody bruised them all with his presence. He wandered outside into the yard. He roamed to the back of the house. Fodderwing's pets were here, caged and forgotten. A 5 months bear cub, brought no doubt to amuse him in his illness, was chained to a stake. It had walked its dusty circle around and around until its chain was tangled and it was held tight against the stake. Its water pan was overturned and empty. At sight of Jody, it rolled on its back and cried with a sound like a human baby. Squeak, the squirrel, ran his endless treadle. His cage had neither food nor water. The possum was asleep in its box. Preacher, the red bird, hopped on his one good leg and pecked at the bare floor of his cage. The raccoon was not in sight. Jody knew where Fodderwing kept sacks of peanuts and corn for his creatures. His brothers had made him a little feed box and kept it filled for him. Jody fed the small things first and watered them. He approached the bear cub cautiously. It was small and roly-poly, but he was not too certain what use it might make of its sharp claws. It whimpered, and he reached out one arm to it. It wrapped all four legs around it and clung desperately. It rubbed its black nose against his shoulder. He untangled it and pulled away from it and straightened its chain and brought it a pan of water. It drank again and again, then took the pan from him with its paws like the hands, he thought, of a baby, and turned the last few cool drops on its stomach. He could have laughed aloud if he were not so heavy with sadness, but it relieved him to care for the animals, to give them, for the time, the comfort that their master could never offer them again. He wondered sorrowfully what would become of them. He played abstractly with them. The sharp joy that he had once felt when Fodderwing shared them was muted. When Racket the raccoon came in from the forest with its queer, uneven gait and recognized him and climbed up his leg to his shoulder and made its plaintive, churring cry and parted his hair with its thin, restless fingers, he longed so painfully for Fodderwing that he had to lie on his belly and beat his feet in the sand. The ache turned into a longing for the fawn. He got up and brought a handful of peanuts for the coon to keep it occupied. He went in search of the fawn. He found it behind a myrtle bush where it had been able to watch unobserved. He thought it might be thirsty, too, and he offered it water from the bear cub's pan. The fawn sniffed and would not drink. He was tempted to feed it a handful of corn from the forester's abundance, but decided it wouldn't be honest to do so. Probably its teeth were still too tender to chew the hard kernels in any case. He sat down under a live oak and held the fawn close to him. There was a comfort in it not to be found in the hairy arms of Buck Forrester. He wondered if his pleasure in Fodderwing's creatures had been dissipated because Fodderwing was gone, or because the fawn now held all he needed of delight. He said to it, "I'd not trade you for all of them, and the cub to boot." A gratifying feeling of faithfulness came over him, that the enchantment of the creatures he had so long coveted couldn't deflect his affections from the fawn. The afternoon was endless. It came to him that something was unfinished. The foresters ignored him, yet somehow he knew they expected him to stay. Buck would have said goodbye to him if he were supposed to go. The sun dropped behind the live oaks. His mother would be angry, yet he was waiting for something, if only dismissal by a sign. He was bound to Fodderwing, tallow white in the bed, and a thing waited that would set him free. At dusk, the foresters filed out of the house and went in silence about their chores. Smoke drifted from the chimney. The smell of fat pine blended with frying meat. He trailed after Buck, driving the cows to water. He offered,
"I done fed and watered the bear cub and the squirrel and them."
Buck touched a switch to a heifer. He said,
"I remembered them once a today, and then my mind went black again."
Jody said,
"Can I help?"
"There's plenty of us here to do. You could wait on Ma like Fodderwing done. Keep up her fire, sich as that."
He went reluctantly into the house. He avoided the sight of the bedroom door. It was drawn almost closed. Ma Forrester was at the hearth. Her eyes were red. She stopped every few moments to touch them with a corner of her apron. Her straggly hair had been wet and brushed back smooth and neat, as though in honor of a guest. He said,
"I come to help."
She turned with a spoon in her hand. She said,
"I've been standing here thinking about your ma. She's buried as many as I got."
He fed the fire unhappily. He was increasingly uneasy, yet he couldn't go. The meal was as meager as the Baxter's own. Ma Forrester set the table indifferently. She said,
"Now I forgot to make coffee. They'd drink coffee when they'd not eat."
She filled the pot and set it on the coals. The Forrester men came one by one to the back porch and washed their hands and faces and combed their hair and beards. There was no talk, no joking and jostling, no noisy stamping. They trooped into the table like men in a dream. Pa Forrester came in from the bedroom. He looked about him wonderingly. He said,
"Ain't it quare?"
Jody sat down next to Ma Forrester. She served the plates with meat, then began to cry. She said,
"I counted him in, same as always. Oh, my Lord, I counted him in."
Buck said,
"Well, now, Ma, Jody'll eat his portion and maybe grow up big as me, hey, boy?"
The family rallied. For a few minutes, they ate hungrily. Then a nauseating fullness came over them, and they pushed away their plates. Ma Forrester said,
"I got no heart to clean up tonight, nor you neither. Just stack the plates till after tomorrow morning."
Release, then, would come in the morning. She looked at Jody's plate. She said,
"You ain't et your biscuit nor drinked your milk, boy. What ailed it 'em?"
"That's for my fawn. I always save him some of my dinner," she said.
"You poor lamb."
She began to cry again.
"Wouldn't my boy have loved to seed your fawn? He talked about it, and he talked about it. He said, 'Jody's got him a brother.'"
Jody felt the hateful thickening of his throat. He swallowed. He said,
"That's how come me to be here. I came for Fodderwing to name my fawn."
"Why,"
she said,
"he named it. Last time he talked about it, he give it a name. He said, 'A fawn carries its flag so merry. A fawn's tail's a little white merry flag. If I had me a fawn, I'd name him Flag. Flag the fawn is what I'd call him.'"
Jody repeated, "Flag." He thought he would burst. Fodderwing had talked of him and had named the fawn. There was a happiness tangled with his grief that was both comforting and unbearable. He said,
I reckon I best go feed him. I best go feed Flag.
He slid from his chair and went outside with a cup of milk and the biscuits. Fodderwing seemed close and living. He called.
Here, Flag?
The fawn came to him, and it seemed to him that it knew the name and had perhaps always known it. He soaked the biscuits in the milk and fed them to it. Its muzzle was soft and wet in his hand. He went back into the house, and the fawn followed. He said,
Can Flag come in? Bring him right in and welcome.
He sat down stiffly on Fodderwing's three-legged stool in the corner. Pa Forrester said,
It'd pleasure him. You coming to sit up with him tonight?
That, then, was the thing expected of him.
And 'twouldn't scarcely be decent burying him in the morning without you here. He didn't have no friend but you.
Jody cast off his anxiety over his mother and father like a too ragged shirt. It was of no importance in the face of matters so grave. Ma Forrester went into the bedroom to take the early vigil. The fawn nosed about the room, smelling of one man after the other, then came and lay down beside Jody. Darkness came tangibly into the house, adding its heaviness to theirs. They sat, smothered under the thick air of sorrow that only the winds of time could blow away. At 9 o'clock, Buck stirred and lit a candle. At 10 o'clock, a horse and rider clattered into the yard. It was Penny, on old Caesar. He dropped the reins over its head and came into the house. Pa Forrester, as head of the house, rose and greeted him. Penny looked about at the dark faces. The old man pointed to the half-open bedroom door. Penny said,
The boy?
Pa Forrester nodded.
Gone or going?
Gone.
I feared it. It come over me. That was what was keeping Jody away.
He laid one hand on the old man's shoulder.
I feel for you.
He spoke to one man after the other. He looked directly at Lem.
Howdy, Lem.
Lem hesitated.
Howdy, Penny.
Millwheel gave him his chair. Penny asked,
When did it happen?
Just at dawn today.
Ma goed in to see what he eat a bite of breakfast.
He'd been laying punishing a day too, and we'd had old Doc, but he seemed to be mending.
The talk broke over Penny in a torrent. The relief of words washed and cleansed a hurt that had been ingrowing. He listened gravely, nodding his head from time to time. He was a small, staunch rock against which their grief might beat. When they finished and fell quiet, he talked of his own losses. It was a reminder that no man was spared. What all had borne, each could bear. He shared their sorrow, and they became a part of his, and the sharing spread their grief a little by thinning it. Buck said,
Likely Jody'd like to set up with him alone a while.
Jody was in a panic when they took him into the room and turned away to close the door. Something sat in a far dark corner of the room, and it was the same thing that had prowled the scrub the night his father had been bitten. He said,
Would it be all right? Did Flag come too?
They agreed that it was seemly, and the fawn was brought to join him. He sat on the edge of the chair. It was warm from Ma Forrester's body. He crossed his hands in his lap. He looked furtively at the face on the pillow. A candle burned on a table at the head of the bed. When the flame flickered, it seemed that Fodderwing's eyelids fluttered. A light breeze stirred through the room. The sheet seemed to lift as though Fodderwing were breathing. After a while, the horror went away, and he could sit back in the chair. When he leaned far back, Fodderwing looked a little familiar. Yet it was not Fodderwing who lay, pinched of cheek under the candlelight. Fodderwing was stumbling about outside in the bushes, with the raccoon at his heels. In a moment he would come into the house with his rocking gait, and Jody would hear his voice. He stole a look at the crossed, crooked fingers. Their stillness was implacable. He cried to himself, soundlessly. The wavering candle was hypnotic, his eyes blurred. He roused himself, but a moment came when his eyes wouldn't open. Death and silence and his sleep were one. He awakened at daylight to a heaviness of spirit. He heard a sound of hammering. Someone had laid him across the foot of the bed. He was wide awake instantly. Fodderwing was gone. He slid from the bed and into the big room. It was empty. He went outside. Penny was nailing a cover on a fresh pine box. The forester stood about. Ma Forester was crying. No one spoke to him. Penny drove the last nail. He asked, "Ready?" They nodded. Buck and Millwheel and Lem moved forward. Buck said, "I can tote it alone." He swung the box to his shoulder. Pa Forester and Gabby were missing. Buck set out toward the south hammock. Ma Forester followed him. Millwheel took hold of her arm. The others dropped in behind them. The procession filed slowly to the hammock. Jody remembered that Fodderwing had a grapevine swing here under a live oak. He saw Pa Forester standing beside it. They had spades in their hands. A raw hole gaped in the earth. The mounded soil beside it was dark with wood mold. The hammock was light with the dawning, for the sunrise reached out luminous fingers parallel with the earth and covered it with brightness. Buck set down the coffin and eased it into the opening. He stepped back. The foresters hesitated. Penny said, "The father first." Pa Forester lifted his spade and shoveled earth on the box. He handed the spade to Buck. Buck threw a few clods. The spade passed from one to the other of the brothers. There was a teacup full of earth remaining. Jody found the spade in his hands. Numb, he scooped the earth and dropped it on the mound. The foresters looked at one another. Pa Forester said, "Penny, you've had Christian raisin. We'd be proud did you say something." Penny advanced to the grave and closed his eyes and lifted his face to the sunlight. The foresters bowed their heads. "O Lord, Almighty God, it ain't for us ignorant mortals to say what's right and what's wrong. Was ary one of us to be a-doing of it, we'd not have brung this poor boy into the world a cripple and his mind touched. We'd have brung him in straight and tall like his brothers, fitting to live and work and do. But in a way of speaking, Lord, you done made it up to him. You give him away with the wild creeters. You give him a sort of wisdom, made him knowing and gentle. The birds come to him, and the varmints moved free about him. And like as not, he could have taken the she-wildcat right in his poor twisted hands. Now you've done seed fit to take him where being crookedy in mind or limb don't matter. But, Lord, it pleasures us to think now you've done straightened out them legs and that poor bent back and them hands. It pleasures us to think on him moving around as easy as ary one. And, Lord, give him a few red birds and maybe a squirrel and a coon and a possum to keep him company, like he had here. All of us is somehow lonesome, and we know he'll not be lonesome, do we have them little wild things around him. If it ain't asking too much, put a few varmints in heaven. Thy will be done. Amen." The foresters murmured, "Amen." Sweat stood on their faces. They came to Penny one by one and wrung his hand. The raccoon came